By the 1970s, cancer was the second leading cause of death in the United States. Scientists, healthcare institutions, and the government decided to take action. So in 1971, the National Cancer Institute was created, and it's been harnessing different research groups, government resources, and the private sector to propel change.
We declared a war as a country on cancer in the 70s, right? And we think about the progress since then. And some things haven't delivered in terms of the expected change in the trajectory of this disease.
Today, cancer continues to be the second leading cause of death, second only to heart disease. It is responsible for approximately 10 million deaths worldwide every year and stands as one of the most important unsolved problems in medicine. And while there is still no cure for cancer, the field of oncology has witnessed remarkable advancements. News of breakthroughs and novel techniques regularly make headlines, offering glimpses of hope.
Well, tonight, a teenager in the United Kingdom is cancer-free after undergoing a new treatment for leukemia. It's called base editing, and it involves altering the patient's DNA.
AI is being used for everything from brain surgery to mind reading and the potential of revolutionizing cancer detection.
Significant funding and research is focused on cancer, leading to ongoing advancements in our approach to the disease. Among the most promising developments is precision oncology, a personalized approach to cancer treatment that tailors therapies based on an individual's unique genetic makeup. I'm Hilary Roboto, and this is Unseen Upside by Cambridge Associates, where we explore investments beyond their returns. And this season, we're talking to leaders and investors behind healthcare innovations that could change how long and how well we live. In this episode, we'll examine how innovation in precision oncology can help in the fight against cancer while also making diagnosis and treatment more equitable.
It's sad to say, but cancer has always been in the background, right? When you have a big enough family, you're aware of it. In my case, it became personal when my dad was diagnosed with prostate cancer. There's two kinds of prostate cancer, one that is relatively well treated, and he had that. And then later in life, he was diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And this cancer generally wears you down. And it's probably the best way to attribute his passing at 87 after a long and healthy life.
Matt Gavart holds a PhD in bioengineering, over 30 patents, and numerous peer-reviewed publications in conference abstracts. And he is a co-founder and board member of a company called Kiatech that's based in Greenville, South Carolina. They're disrupting cancer care by accurately predicting a patient's response before treatment begins. But before we tell you how they do it, let's start with the disease. Cancer happens at a cellular level. Every cell in your body is like a tiny factory, churning out all sorts of proteins. Some of these proteins are like architects, giving cells their structure, while others are messengers, allowing cells to talk to each other and respond to what's happening around them. And then you've got the enzymes, controlling the metabolic processes that keep everything running smoothly. But when mutations mess with our DNA, which is like the biological instruction manual, things can go haywire. Suddenly, abnormal or damaged cells can grow and multiply when they shouldn't, and they can form tumors, which are tissue lumps. Tumors can be benign or cancerous, and some types of cancer don't form tumors at all. The disease was first described about 5,000 years ago in Egypt, way before we gave it the name cancer. And ever since scientists got a hold of microscopes, they've been examining tumor cells and accumulating data about the disease. Cancer can start almost anywhere in the human body. So today we understand it as a group of more than 100 different diseases, with breast, lung, and colon cancer among the most common.
Medicine is about knowledge applicable to groups of patients. And in the first versions of cancer treatment, decision-making, which drugs to give, who to give them to, you had these large groups, like breast cancer.
Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer for women in this country. And it can be categorized into some subtypes, such as HER2-positive, which is where the cancer cells have a protein called human epidermal growth factor receptor 2, HER2, or ER-positive, in which the cancer grows in response to estrogen.
What happened was the emergence of information that allowed people to move how specific the recommendation is from that broad label, breast cancer, into subpopulations of HER2-positive breast cancer and ER-positive breast cancer. So basically, it became more personal as the group of people that treatment decisions are made for gets smaller, and then you can go smaller and smaller. And ultimately, what that leads to, if you just keep going small enough, is an N of one.
This path has been paved by years of work from many scientists and institutions, including St. Jude Children's Research Hospital.
We treat kids with cancer and other catastrophic diseases, but we always are trying to get better at what we do. We want to try to advance cures.
Rick Shadiak is the president and CEO of ALSAC, the fundraising and awareness organization for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital.
When we opened our doors in 1962, survival rates for the most common form of childhood cancer, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, was 4%. So 96 out of 100 kids would pass away and pass away quickly. Fast forward to today, and due in large part to the research and treatment done at St. Jude, survival rate for that very disease is now 94%.
St. Jude is a research hospital, which means that while doctors are treating patients, scientists are studying the specific cancers.
About 50% of what we do is research. Most of our patients are on some type of research protocol as well. Technology has allowed us to advance treatment opportunities for kids.
And not only treatment has advanced. In 2010, St. Jude and Washington University launched a $65 million project to sequence the genomes of 600 pediatric cancer patients. Their goal was to understand the genetic basis of childhood cancer.
Some had done individual disease types, but nobody had done it across the entire spectrum. We decided to do that. The results from that pediatric cancer genome project have been stunning. We shared those results freely with the world, and now we're using those to refine our treatments at St. Jude.
But understanding the genetics of the disease is just a stepping stone towards treating it, because every cancer patient is different.
The most personal medicine that you can get is directed towards you, towards your biology, towards your disease, towards restoring your health. So, Dr. Roboto, so if you're a doctor and you're looking across your desk at a cancer patient and you're deciding on what drug to use under today's processes, you're looking at them and then you're assessing, okay, I'm going to make the decision on that patient based on other people's outcomes in the past. So how much are you like the people that the drug worked for, and how much are you like the people that it didn't work for? And it's an extrapolation based on events that happened in the past in other people. If we could move that process to give you better information, Dr. Roboto, and you were saying to yourself, okay, what I want is this patient in front of me's cells to die. That's what you want, right? When you give a patient cancer drugs, you want dead cancer cells inside their body. So if I was basing that decision on your cells died when exposed to this drug, it's a different basis for your personalized medicine decision.
And that's what the QIAtech team has accomplished. They have designed platforms that can provide clinicians with highly accurate treatment recommendations based on the unique makeup of a patient's tumor. Matt says the process is similar to how we use antibiotics to treat people with bacterial infections.
There's a guy named Petrie in Germany in the late 1800s, and he was growing bacteria in his lab in a dish that is now called the Petri dish, right? But the difference is bacteria has relatively simple biology. And way back then, when bacteria died in the lab, they died in the patient's body. So there is this really good correlation between what happens in the lab and its direct implications for the patient you got the bacteria from. Cancer biology, human cancer biology, is a lot more complicated than bacterial biology. That connection between what dies in the lab and what is going to die in the patient has generally eluded us for a good couple of decades. Mostly the opposition is really skepticism because it's been tried and not worked. And so really it's a story of something that is intuitive and that everyone could get behind. The real question is, does it work from a technical perspective?
Functional precision medicine is an approach where doctors test drugs directly on a patient's tumor cells to see which ones work best. This helps to tailor patient-specific treatment with better outcomes. And Matt's team at Kiatech is getting this done by using live cells to create a lab replica of the cancer.
We are merely implementing the thinking that drives the very successful use of antibiotics on a personalized level. We're just merely doing that in cancer because our knowledge of how to manipulate biology and grow it in a lab has really advanced. My PhD is in biomedical engineering, which is bio plus medical plus engineering, right? And so it combines all three of those things, and they're really important to get this right for human cancer cell culture.
Matt says the past couple of decades have brought tremendous advances in tissue engineering and regenerative medicine, allowing innovation like what's behind the Kiatech products. They use cells that come directly from cancer patients to create what they call, quote, complex cell cultures with maximized fidelity to human biology, end quote.
Functional precision oncology implies the use of live cells. So if you think about getting information from a cancer patient's body, and you're going to do it based on some sort of a tissue analysis, so they're going to take a biopsy or use specimens from a surgical resection procedure. So when the tissue comes out of the body, it's alive. Under standard workflows, one of the first things they do is basically kill it. And it's technically called fixing it, but basically you're going to put it into a liquid with formaldehyde, and it is designed to very efficiently fix the tissue by killing the cells and preserving it. Why? Because you don't want it to degrade, right?
But killing the cells doesn't work for functional precision oncology.
That would be non-functional because you're not using anybody's live cells and you're not measuring how they function in response to a given stimulus. So you think about functional as take a live cell, hit it with a drug, watch what happens. Ask a lot of questions about how does it interact with the drug mechanistically, all these things. But at the end of the day, did it die? Yes or no?
So how is this possible? Since the beginning of medicine, there has been a real desire to grow human cells in a lab. And for decades, this was unsuccessful. But then in 1951, a woman by the name of Henrietta Lacks, who was a Black mother with cervical cancer, went to Johns Hopkins Hospital for treatment. And doctors actually took cells from her tumor without her permission. These cells were the first to survive and multiply in a lab, leading to countless medical studies and the development of numerous drugs. And with over half a century of innovation, things have changed in how scientists are able to grow the cells too.
Two-dimensional cell culture is when cells are being grown on a flat surface, like the bottom of a petri dish. They have a form that often looks like kind of like a pancake, and together they make a cobblestone surface that is two-dimensional and flat. 3D cell culture implies that the cell is probably more naturally shaped in something like roughly spheroid or sphere. It's surrounded in all of its dimensions by either other cells or extracellular matrix. And the cells in your body, the ones that matter for cancer in your tissues, are largely three-dimensional. You're a three-dimensional organism. Your cells are in 3D. And when you move the cells into a 2D, it's like you've taken them and put them on the moon or in some alien environment. They act differently. The data you get from them has very limited relevance to the real cells in your body. And that's why this didn't work for decades. The world needs but doesn't have way better information that comes from more complicated cell culture.
From an engineering perspective, the company developed a solution that recreates a solid tumor environment inside the lab and plugs cancer cells into it. The commercial platform is called 3D Predict, and the process is fairly simple. So consider that someone you know has been diagnosed with GBM, which is a type of brain tumor.
If their doctor is in our network of ordering clinical sites. They have a tube of liquid in their fridge. And what happens is in the surgery that's already been scheduled and the tissue that's already being removed, they take some of that tissue, they put it in the tube, seal it up, and they ship it to us overnight. So basically that live tissue is making its way from the patient's body into the surgery suite and into our labs. Then we take that tissue, we process it in such a way that we recreate their living biology in between 600 and 1,000 little replicates, we call them, basically little spheroids. Each one of those is a shot on goal to hit it with a drug and measure what happens, hit it with a drug, measure what happens, right? So each of those is a data point on what did their live cells do.
At QIAtech, Matt says they generally are testing a 12-drug panel.
So we're looking at independently 12 different drugs to get a read on, okay, this one, but not that one over there, but not this one over here. And that is a little bit like a fingerprint relative to what that patient is going to respond to. We turn that back to the doctor within 7 days. That's long before they're going to start the drug therapy because they're still recovering from surgery. But that's when the doctors want it because they want that information quickly to do their planning.
QIAtech published their results on brain and ovarian cancer with an 85% success rate in clinical studies.
We have an impressive correlation between when things die in the lab, predicting response, and then it actually happens to be the case where the patient responds in that way. And that's exciting. That puts us in a relatively small bucket of companies who put up the data to actually, you know, put our money where our mouth is relative to showing that this works as a result of results in clinical trials.
QIAtech is just at the beginning of their journey, but clinical teams are getting exposed to their innovation, and some patients have actually sought them out directly. And their system also supports QIAtech Predict, which is a platform for pharmaceutical companies working on clinical trials.
In terms of functional precision oncology, we're at the state of introducing a new thing that has to meet really important yes-no performance criteria, and that is really important. But that's where we are. We are going to do a lot of good by doing the heavy lifting of basically introducing the change. And then after that becomes successful and ubiquitous, there is so much potential for then tweaking it. Changing cancer is hard, like period. With the technology working where it is, the problems are people problems because we have to convince a doctor to do something different. We have to convince insurance companies and Medicare to do something different. I'm excited about that because every time we do that, we're helping a cancer patient. And also we're capturing the value. The world I want to live in is one where patients routinely respond to their cancer drugs. We're not there today, and we're not going to get there unless we do something different.
When I think about precision medicine, I think about tremendous opportunity to improve health outcomes for everyone.
Jason Robart is co-founder and managing partner at Sia Ventures, an early-stage healthcare venture fund founded by former healthcare executives. Before founding Sia, Jason was chief strategy officer at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. And Jason grew up in Roxbury, a neighborhood of Boston, in the 60s and 70s.
As a result, really saw firsthand and experienced some of the racial strife that was taking place in Boston at the time and, frankly, across the country as we sought to desegregate the school systems.
And for Jason, that inequality became apparent at a young age.
We were a pretty low-income family. And when I was 17, my father was diagnosed with stomach cancer just before Thanksgiving of that year. And he died about 4.5 months later. You know, obviously very sad for the family and had an impact on my life at that point. Fast forward, gosh, about 35 years, I had done relatively well. I was chief strategy officer of Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts at the time. And I was sitting in my office overlooking the south end of Boston and Lower Roxbury. And it hit me really for the first time of, wait a minute, here I am, stone's throw from Mass General, from Brigham and Women, from Dana-Farber, and I'm at Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts. And I thought back to 35 years earlier, and why was it that substandard care was getting delivered less than 2 miles away? not through any fault of the providers who are doing exceptional work with what they have, but that the incredible technological advancements that have been made were not affecting all people equally. And this was just a 2-mile zip code difference.
And Jason says that this was one of the catalysts behind starting Sia Ventures.
We focus on two groups that have traditionally been underserved. One is women and BIPOC founders, and the numbers are staggering that women receive roughly 2% of all venture dollars, and women of color, that number is under 1% of all venture dollars. And I'm not a statistician by any stretch of the imagination, but you can't tell me that 51% of the population only has 2% of the good ideas.
Sia is also drawn to companies like Kaiatech that are working on solutions that serve traditionally underserved or vulnerable populations.
I got introduced to Kaiatech from a doc, former chief medical officer of a large health plan, who knew a little bit about what we were doing. I was struck by both Matt's enthusiasm and passion for the company and the data on being able to better predict the response that a patient might have to different types of cancer therapies. And when the provider actually took that into account and made a decision that aligned with Kaiatech's predictive models, that patient had a longer period of progression-free survival and overall survival than if the provider went with the more traditional standard of care. So the data was really compelling.
Jason consulted diagnostic companies, pharma companies, and many others who agreed on the need for a system like Kaiatech's.
One of the criteria that we look at with portfolio companies is their ability to integrate into the provider workflow. So we're not asking providers to do something different. Change is hard, right? And the last thing we want to do is make the change harder for providers or payers. The way in which the solution at Kaiatech works is that live cancer cell is sent to Kaiatech. Within 7 days, that provider has an answer back from Kaiatech that says, based on our analysis, Jason will respond best to X, not Y.
And Kaiatech's technology also offers a solution to some of the other challenges in the fight against cancer.
Particularly for low income, for rural, for vulnerable populations. If we think about care from a population health perspective, there aren't a whole lot of folks that look like me or that have my background in clinical trial data. Women are underrepresented in clinical trial data. So is there an opportunity to take the learnings that we've had perhaps from the traditional clinical trials, the studies that have been done, marry that with the advancements that are taking place, and then making that care specific to Jason Robart, not people that look like Jason, but specific to Jason Robart.
When it comes to cancer treatment, speed matters, but unfortunately, most patients do not get on the right therapy on their first try. And all that does is prolong suffering as the disease progresses, plus it piles on extra medical costs. Basically, not identifying the optimal treatment up front can set patients back in a major way.
How can we get that therapeutic response that is specific to my needs as an individual or your needs as an individual as quickly and as efficiently as possible? That's where I think precision medicine really can lead to significantly better health outcomes and, ironically, ultimately lower costs, because we're going to get that person onto the care that they need out of the gate.
At Sia Ventures, Jason's team focuses on helping companies reach their highest potential with more than just money.
Entrepreneurs and early stage companies need funding, but they actually need your expertise more than they need your funding.
Jason says that that's the foundation of Sia's work.
We provide capital, absolutely. But it's our knowledge of the market, our knowledge of how do you navigate a health plan or a provider system to sell your product or service within that organization. How do you think about contracting? How do you think about a product roadmap that speaks to the needs of the payer, provider, or patient today, but is also a platform play that can evolve as we move forward? I think that's really what our secret sauce is. It's the hands-on experience as folks coming out of a large payer where as chief strategy officer at Blue Cross, I made many of the buying decisions mm-hmm. that our portfolio company CEOs and management teams are seeking to get.
SIA is focused on access and equity in healthcare, but making this vision a reality has many challenges.
The biggest challenge around health equity or inequities, as the case may be, is making sure that we are addressing the full problem and all of the root causes to that inequity. Some of those are making sure that providers that are serving traditionally underserved, low-income, rural population have the tools, the resources, the technology to be able to deliver care in a way that is appropriate for the population that they are serving. Some of it is the way insurance works in the country. There are obviously a number of social determinants of health. It's a great question of how do we solve for health equity, and it's a really complicated answer.
SIA is not alone in their efforts. At the core of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is healthcare access and equity.
I'm Aubrey. I went to St. Jude because I had a cancerous tumor.
These kids, they don't deserve to have to go through this. My beautiful little redheaded girl has cancer. You don't know what's going to happen.
St. Jude came into existence to address healthcare inequity in the United States.
ALSEC CEO Rick Shadiak.
ALSEC stands for American Lebanese Syrian Associated Charities. We exist for no other purpose other than to raise the money that's necessary for St. Jude and to create the awareness that's necessary for our mission.
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and ALSEC were created by the same person in the 1950s.
Danny Thomas went around the United States asking people that shared his heritage to help him build St. Jude Children's Research Hospital as a way to say thank you to God and the United States of America for giving their parents, my grandparents, the opportunity to come to this country and to make a life. And my dad signed up and went on to serve this mission for over 50 years. And my brother and I have been fundraising for St. Jude since we were little kids, going door to door with canisters, trying to collect coins back in those days.
The mission of St. Jude has been an important part of Rick's life and an important part of the history of medicine in this country.
I want to take you back to the 1950s and the 1960s. And in 1962, we opened our doors in Memphis, Tennessee, and that was a segregated city. Kids who were Black or kids of color were routinely turned away from medical institutions around the South in the United States of America simply because of the color of their skin. Our founder, Danny Thomas, that first generation of board members like my father, were courageous enough to say, this is completely unacceptable. And from day one, we're going to open our doors and make it available to kids of all races, creeds, religions. We're going to take all the economic circumstances completely out of the equation. And every child deserves the same chance at survival. We've been true to that for over 60 years from day one. No family receives a bill from St. Jude for treatment, travel, housing, or food. So mom and dad can focus on getting their child better.
St. Jude has helped address healthcare inequities, but Rick says they still exist.
No parent should have to make decisions based upon how good their healthcare insurance is or how much money's in their bank account. I'm not naive. I know that's not the world that we live in, okay? I think it's the utopia that we all strive for. But the reality is, while we've addressed it here in the United States, around the globe, we have a big problem, okay? The single biggest determinant of whether a child survives cancer is where that child lives. That is completely unacceptable. Why should a child that's born in Haiti or El Salvador not have the same chance at survival as a child that's born in the United States? That's not fair. We're still not where we need to be, but we have a partially solvable problem. Let's take what we've learned in the United States and export that around the globe. For the last three or four decades, we've trained the global clinical workforce in the pediatric space. We continue to do that, expanding our reach to more than 80 countries, but now we're going to also provide free cancer medications to 120,000 of the 400,000 kids around the globe that are going to get cancer this year. That's what St. Jude is doing with our St. Jude Global Initiative, where we seek to raise survival rates around the globe. for six most common forms of childhood cancer from 20% to 60% by 2030 in an effort to address healthcare inequity.
To continue propelling innovation and change, organizations like St. Jude and Kiatek require investment.
I want to urge and remind people is there's various ways that you can make investments to kind of advance healthcare, right? You can invest in stock in these companies that do fabulous work, or you can invest in missions like St. Jude Children's Research Hospital.
It's just so easy to be motivated by serving the needs of nonprofit health systems because of the importance that they have with our communities, but with us individually and with our families and friends, just helping people get better. So it's quite an easy cause.
Jeff Blasek is a partner and head of the Northeast and Midwest Endowment and Foundation Practice at Cambridge Associates. He has more than 25 years of investment experience, including a decade advising healthcare systems. One of his clients is St. Jude. And Jeff works closely in partnership with LSAC's Chief Investment Officer, Anurag Pandit, and his team on their investment strategy. Jeff is so passionate about his work with St. Jude that he has also run two half marathons they hosted in Memphis to raise funds for the hospital.
St. Jude's is a special organization, and I've had the honor of working with them for a little over 4 years now. And the entire experience has been one of my favorites as an investor. The team thinks and works tirelessly on behalf of the kids. And I will never forget how emotional it was the first time I did a tour of their campus in Memphis to see how impactful this has been on saving children's lives. I'm not sure there's a more complicated business in the world than running a hospital. And when you think about all the things that have to come together, you have to have a day-to-day management of the demands of providing care, but then you have to have a multi-year strategy of making sure that you have the best technologies and innovations. And then you have to bring it all together and run it profitably. It's a lot of moving pieces.
Jeff has worked with some of the top healthcare systems in the country. And he says that for these types of institutions, investment is a complex topic.
Healthcare systems are going to have a lot of give and take. They're going to have these balance sheet assets that some years when they're good and there's not a lot of need on capital, they can accumulate. And then other years, as we saw with COVID in 2020, where they're going to have to draw in. And so all of that flexibility has to be factored in on an investment portfolio in a way that is challenging, but also really interesting.
For Jeff, the most important goal is to be able to serve liquidity needs while balancing the need to grow strategically in the long run.
If you go too far down one path without balancing the other path, you can get yourself in trouble.
And as it relates to the investments that healthcare systems make, there's often a focus around healthcare innovation.
The healthcare systems are often in a position where they can observe it more than our typical clients, because this is the day-to-day business of what they do. The challenge is these innovations, first of all, involve significant risk. There can be a very promising pharmaceutical opportunity or device or data platform that will have the potential to dramatically change and improve healthcare delivery. And while on paper that will look promising, as we know, the execution can really be the difference between success and failure. And so what is interesting is how do the healthcare systems then delineate between having innovation of healthcare naturally occurring in their investment portfolios. And we think it's important to have that healthcare, but also have technology, have growth equity, a more diversified base. And then for those situations that are more specialized in promising devices and pharmaceuticals and technologies for the application of healthcare, what we have noted is many of the larger institutions have created their own incubators, internal innovation laboratories, and really made sure that they acknowledge that there's dual needs with this. They would love to earn a high degree of return, multiples of their capital, if this works. They want to incentivize their people, but they also want to just make sure that they're experiencing cost benefits or other things that will help them really be aligned with the innovation.
And because every cancer and every patient are different, innovations related to precision oncology are in high demand.
I'm an optimist, it's true.
Kiatek's Matt Gavart.
I've been accused of it accurately, but I really believe that we are living in a time where we are going to change the trajectory of cancer.
Matt thinks the future of functional precision oncology is predictable.
This is resource and time intensive. Cancer has the market opportunity where investors can be attracted to that and realize it as the values happens. It's advancing the war on cancer by having a single unit establish a beachhead and then growing that and then growing it and growing it.
And St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is one of the hospitals working tirelessly to find new and better ways of treating cancer.
The problem of childhood cancer is a multi-year, multinational, multi-trillion dollar problem. It's not going to be solved overnight. It's taken us 60 years to get to where we are, but I am so excited about all the technological advances that I think are going to accelerate progress. I think that we all should really pay attention over the coming decade to see all the great things that are going to happen in science and medicine, and it's going to be driven by investments. I think about how unfair it is for some of these families that are burdened with a child that's catastrophically ill, and I want to change those odds for those families, and I want to have them experience happiness. I want to see more and more kids grow up to lead full and complete lives. I can't wait for one of these kids to take my job.
If you want to learn more, please visit us at cambridgeassociates.com/unseenupside or check out the show notes. And if you like what you're hearing, leave us a review and tell your friends and colleagues. At Cambridge Associates, our podcast team includes Michelle Pan and me, Hillary Roboto. And a special thank you to Megan Morrissey, Robert Scherzer, Krista Matthews, Deirdre Nechtau, and Michelle Moore and Jennifer Poyer. This episode was produced by Sandra Lopez Monsalve, with support from Isabel Hibbard and Emmanuel Desarme. Genevieve Sponsler is our editor, and audio mastering by Samantha Gatzik. And the executive producer of PRX Productions is Jocelyn Gonzalez. Next time on Unseen Upside, join us as we take a look at the growing obesity epidemic and the promising new treatment options that have emerged to help fight it.
You think about the obesity epidemic going from 13% in 1980 to 42%, and this is just the United States alone, but there's solutions now to this problem, and it is a real problem. A lot of people think obesity, again, is cosmetic. It's not. It's a disease, and we need to acknowledge that that's the first step in solving the problem.
Before you go, one of our colleagues has an important message about the contents of this podcast.
This is Megan Morrissey from Cambridge Associates Boston office. This podcast should not be copied, distributed, published, or reproduced in whole or in part. The information contained in this podcast does not constitute a recommendation from any Cambridge Associates entity to the listener. The term CA or Cambridge Associates may refer to any one or more Cambridge Associates entities. Neither Cambridge Associates nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Cambridge Associates, and Cambridge Associates is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice or recommendations in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by Cambridge Associates to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any Cambridge Associates entity. Thank you. From PRX.